storage of wealth well represented by the idea of the body of a giant cetacean is an enticement both to the unconsciousness of undeserved privilege and the proliferation of the scavengers motivated by their own narcissism and psychopathy to do nothing but strip that carcass of its stored value. The moral danger of wealth and privilege, an enticement to immature hedonistic narcissism. This implies that the strictures of brute natural necessity can also be viewed as regulatory and salutary, however terrible and even potentially deadly they might be. The wealthy have everything they need, excepting deprivation. Worse, the same is true of their children. God only knows what that threat finally entails on the existential and social front. There is a deeper meaning here, too. When the wisdom of the past is forgotten or betrayed, that is an occurrence equivalent to the death of God, the lost value then lurks unconsciously in the remnant institutions and traditions of that past. This is the reversion to the implicit of what was once explicit, or at least more explicit. This is a transformation aptly represented in narrative as the descent of the father into the belly of the whale. This has implications for the hero as well, as we also see in the story of Pinocchio. The lost, even prodigal son of the now missing father may well find himself called or impelled by conscience to journey into the abyss, into the entrails even of the most terrifying denizen of the deep, to find and rescue the now implicit or unconscious spirit of the patriarch. This is an analog of Christ's harrowing of hell. But unto every one of us is given grace according to the measure of the gift of Christ. Wherefore he saith, when he ascended up on high, he led captivity captive and gave gifts unto men. Now that he ascended, what is it but that he also descended first into the lower parts of the earth? He that descended is the same also that ascended up far above all heavens, that he might fill all things. Ephesians 4:7-10. This is, by tradition, the rescue of Adam and Eve from the abyss, as well as a variant of the primordial and fundamental dragon treasure motif. Remember, with regard to this equivalence, that Pinocchio's monstro literally transforms into a fire-breathing dragon when he manifests himself in his most dangerous guise. This is no easy trick for an aquatic animal, by the way, but it still makes sense to the viewer of the story. Does all this not mean that the god who dies is by necessity entombed, symbolically speaking, in the corpse of a whale? Does that not mean that the hero who now searches risks his own entrapment until he revivifies his father, thereby freeing both God and man? All this is also part of finding what most desperately needs to be found in the most dangerous and unlikely of places. In sterquilinis inventor, as the ancient alchemists had it, in filth it will be found. Now the Lord had prepared a great fish to swallow up Jonah, and Jonah was in the belly of the fish 3 days and 3 nights. Jonah 1:17. This provides precisely the kind of narrative detail that reductive rationalists cite when trying to demonstrate the lack of veracity characterizing the biblical accounts. Although it is technically possible for a large enough whale to engulf a grown man in its mouth and even to swallow him, there is no space within such creatures, a la monstro in Pinocchio, that could be inhabited, however temporarily, let alone for a 3-day period. Furthermore, the idea that someone on the outs with God could be identified by the casting of lots is indicative of the kind of superstitious mindset we moderns have thankfully outgrown, or so we arrogantly think in the time of the New Age. Thus, it is foolish to believe such things when the clarity and objective truth of rationality and science beckons as alternative, or so goes the argument, of Marx, of Freud, of Darwin, at least by implication, of Dawkins, by intent. It is said the entire archaic library should be, if not thrown out altogether, relegated to the domain reserved for children, naive adults, and students of anachronistic mythology, preferably those with plenty of time on their hands, then replaced. With what? There's the rub. By the insistence that sex, Freud, Darwin, Dawkins, far worse, the Marquis de Sade, or power, Nietzsche, Foucault, rules instead? By the terrible, devouring nihilism that Nietzsche, for all his faults, so accurately foretold? By the idiot immaturity fostered by the devouring Oedipal mother? By the blandishments of the hedonists, who worship the very sex postulated as both fundament and pinnacle by those who confuse the momentary, although highly valuable, pleasure of the bed and boudoir with the continuance of the species? The existence of tropes such as the devouring cetacean of the story of Jonah does make it hard going for scientists too daft and self-satisfied to learn anything about literature, and equally for those believers who insist upon a naive literalism. That is not a problem, however, that should preoccupy or concern anyone conducting a serious investigation into narrative significance, not least because those who make such claims generally do not understand what they mean when they use a term such as literal. They mean true, and identify true with literal, but that indicates little besides philosophical naivety of the most profound sort. Jonah's story is a warning. Pick up your damn cross and bear it, or face the consequences. And what is worse yet than the cross? Hell. Hell for you, for those you love, and for everyone else. And a hell that is on you, of your doing, for remaining silent when you have something to say, for running away or escaping into unconsciousness when the voice of God, as the ineluctable call of conscience, makes itself known. Pick up the hell of human making and hoist that too. When you are required to speak truth into possibility, to make, maintain, or reconstitute the order that is good, and you reject the call, you invite the devil himself into the game. Really, truly. Or did we learn anything from the great moral catastrophes of the 20th century? The answer? Very little. And bloody well beware of presuming that in the situation facing Jonah, you would have acted differently. Jonah is every man, even better than most. When push comes to shove, after all, that reluctant prophet at least had the decency to admit to his error to save those he was traveling with. What makes you so sure you would do the same? What makes you so sure that the silence you are almost inevitably maintaining right now in your life about things of absolutely cardinal import, of import to you, by your own standards, is not dooming you and those you love to absolute perdition? How do you think totalitarian states establish themselves? It is not the obedience of the glorious would-be free to the solely dominating tyrant that creates the totalitarian state. It is instead the allegiance of every damned soul to the dominion of the lie, and silence when there is truth to be told is the most subtle and perhaps even the most inexcusable lie. As we learned from Solzhenitsyn, everyone in a tyranny lies about absolutely everything to themselves and to everyone they purport to love all the time. It is the classic Soviet joke. We pretend to work and they pretend to pay us. And it is worth thinking about just who would formulate and tell such a joke for the rest of your life.
Arbeit macht frei.
Mutual assured destruction. Mad. Satan himself is an evil clown, ruler over the bitter parody of God's creation that inevitably emerges when those who could know better bite their tongue or give it over entirely to the great deceiver himself. It is the rare person indeed who, when push comes to shove, will not put his or her head in the sand. Are you everything you could be? Or have you instead hidden your candle under a bushel and thereby refused to light the world? Matthew 14-15. Is the world not therefore markedly lesser for your reticence and rejection? How much of a hole has your failure to realize the best within you left in the world? How much is that hole, that wound even, that gaping wound even? Because that is certainly how you and those around you experience the consequences, even if that experience has remained unconscious. A portal to hell itself. The one willing to give expression to conscience, the Old Testament prophet, is the exception, not the norm. He is the one willing to say, come what may, and God's terrible will be done. The one who knows that, terrible though that will may be, and this is a deadly serious caution, the alternative can be and has been almost unimaginably worse. The one who in small numbers says the words that could have saved even Sodom and Gomorrah. Genesis 18-19. What do you know about the way things should be that gives your prediction a certainty above the consequences of the truth? Why are you so convinced that your wish, will, and whim should take precedence over what merely lays itself out with ultimately irresistible force when the truth is spoken? There are, too, soul-deadening as well as practically deadly consequences for hiding your light from yourself and your fellow man, for rejecting the call of destiny, however minor it may initially appear, for pretending that you are less good or less evil than you truly are. How did the Nazis gain the upper hand? Because of the silence of the good. How did the Soviets maintain the rule of evil for 7 decades? Because of the silence of the good. How did the brutal monsters of Maoist China murder tens of millions with gleeful impunity? Because of the silence of the good. Butter would not melt in their mouths. Ignore your conscience at the peril of hell. Really, truly. As it is said, if you bring forth what is within you, what you bring forth will save you. If you do not bring forth what is within you, what you do not bring forth will destroy you. Is this not how God balances the cosmos, morally? As it is also said, for unto whomsoever much is given, of him shall be much required. Luke 12:48. There is as well a terrible warning at the beginning of that passage from Luke. But he that knew not and did commit things worthy of stripes shall be beaten with few stripes. Stripes means lashes with the whip, most often the whip of fate. The statement means, if you erred, but truly did not know better, you will be punished comparatively lightly for the mistake. It is in such a manner that the providence of God protects the innocent, even the naive. But no such mercy is reserved for those who know better and sin, whether by commission or omission. If you err, in spite of your own true knowledge, you will be punished not only by the consequences of that error, but also for the much greater crime of betraying yourself, and worse, betraying that which eternally serves as the true guide. And how can you ever be found if you turn voluntarily from that and have therefore become lost? Cast into hell, Jonah repents, lifting his eyes once again above the horizon, orienting himself along the axis of Jacob's ladder, placing his head in the stars, gathering his faith in the very abyss itself. Faith is the courage to be instead of to not be, despite the catastrophe of existence. Faith is the courage to determine to maintain stalwart and upward aim at the good, even in the midst of hell. Yet I will look again toward thy holy temple. Then Jonah prayed unto the Lord his God out of the fish's belly, and said, I cried by reason of mine affliction unto the Lord, and he heard me. Out of the belly of hell cried I, and thou heardest my voice. For thou hadst cast me into the deep, in the midst of the seas, and the floods compassed me about. All thy billows and thy waves passed over me. Then I said, I am cast out of thy sight, yet I will look again toward thy holy temple. The waters compassed me about, even to the soul. The depth closed me round about. The weeds were wrapped about my head. I went down to the bottoms of the mountains. The earth with her bars was about me forever. Yet hast thou brought up my life from corruption, O Lord, my God. When my soul fainted within me, I remembered the Lord, and my prayer came in unto thee, into thine holy temple. They that observe lying vanities forsake their own mercy. Jonah 2:1-8. They that observe lying vanities forsake their own mercy. Indeed, did the whale really swallow Jonah? Is it not only the terminally naive who believe such things? Perhaps, insofar as belief can be the childish faith in the genuine rather than metaphorical existence of Santa Claus. But even then, the desire to maintain this belief is understandable and even admirable, insofar as it is part of a genuine attempt to maintain the foundational or aspirational belief that characterizes nothing less than Judeo-Christian civilization itself. Furthermore, those with the temerity to presume that their attitude of hypothetically enlightened doubt is the proper and admirable response to these deepest of all fairy tales manifest a naivety of equal depth. Naivety conjoined with a moral superiority and worship of untrammeled intellect that makes of that naivety something prideful and perverse. That combination of lack of discernment on the literary front and intellectual arrogance is something more than capable of gathering the forces of the abyss around itself, as all those that have the eyes to see and the ears to hear, Matthew 11:15, should now be able to perceive. It is the falsely wise who confuse their inability and unwillingness to separate wheat from chaff in relationship to these ancient stories with genuine, even scientific, enlightenment. Moral dwarfs equipped with hydrogen bombs. The whale always and inevitably closes its jaws over the Jonahs who have determined to be silent, and drags them to the most dreadful of underworlds, and most stay there in the belly of the beast after having dragged those they love down with them. And that is the lesson of the 20th century. Have we learned it? Or does a deeper hell yet await us? Jonah manages the impossible. In the abysmal depths, he expresses his gratitude. Job, much later, does the same. That is also not naivety. It is instead the bloody but unbowed courage of faith itself despite the horrors of the world. Because of this, in combination with God's grace, the cursed prophet returns from the grip of death and the underworld. But I will sacrifice unto thee with the voice of thanksgiving. I will pay that I have vowed. Salvation is of the Lord. And the Lord spake unto the fish, and it vomited out Jonah upon the dry land. Jonah 2, 1-10. In the aftermath of his descent and his resurrection, Jonah puts the devil behind him, just as Christ does after 40 nights and days in the desert, and advances towards Nineveh with the truth welling up inside him and spilling over. He has become the man who sought out and found the light in the darkness. He has become the man who has deeply learned what to fear and what not to fear. The deep blue sea, hell, and God himself, not his own ease and comfort, and not his fellow man. He has learned not to seek the security of his own body and the quelling of his desires, but the salvation of his very soul. He has become the man whose depth of suffering has made his word irresistible, even to those who are sinning deeply themselves. And the word of the Lord came unto Jonah the second time, saying, Arise, go unto Nineveh, that great city, and preach unto it the preaching that I bid thee. So Jonah arose and went unto Nineveh, according to the word of the Lord. Now Nineveh was an exceeding great city of 3 days' journey. And Jonah began to enter into the city a day's journey, and he cried and said, Yet 40 days, and Nineveh shall be overthrown. So the people of Nineveh believed God and proclaimed a fast and put on sackcloth, from the greatest of them even to the least of them. For word came unto the king of Nineveh, and he arose from his throne, and he laid his robe from him, and covered him with sackcloth, and sat in ashes. And he caused it to be proclaimed and published through Nineveh by the decree of the king and his nobles, saying, Let neither man nor beast, herd nor flock, taste anything. Let them not feed nor drink water, but let man and beast be covered with sackcloth and cry mightily unto God. Yea, let them turn every one from his evil way and from the violence that is in their hands. Who can tell if God will turn and repent and turn away from his fierce anger, that we perish not? And God saw their works, that they turned from their evil way. And God repented of the evil that he had said that he would do unto them, and he did it not. Jonah 3, 1-10. The word of the one eternally redeems the many. The truth that reveals itself in the soul of man must find its expression in the world for paradise to reveal itself, or at least for hell and its ruler to be kept at bay. God is eternally willing to show his mercy to those who repent despite their past sins, despite even their enmity with God's chosen people themselves, the Jews. God forgives and sheaths his sword, but man does not. Thus, Jonah finds himself outraged by the escape of his foes from the divine wrath he believes should be justly visited upon them. He tells God that he ran from Tarshish in the first place when called upon to speak, not least because he suspected that if he did so, those upon whom he wished the utmost harm would be presented with the opportunity to repent and survive. Thus, the story tells us that those who remain silent may also do so because their revelation of truth might free even their enemies from suffering, an unacceptable outcome, to those who have not yet learned to love their foes or to drop their desire for vengeance. 9.1. Jonah repents of his virtue. Jonah has thereby done a very good deed. He does not so easily forgive himself, however, for the dreadful crime of redeeming his enemies, and he acts and speaks in a manner that indicates that he is none too happy with God for requiring him to do so. In fact, he is so upset by the success of his venture that he calls upon God to end his existence. Therefore now, O Lord, take, I beseech thee, my life from me, for it is better for me to die than to live. Jonah 4:3. We should once again beware of imagining ourselves better than the now miserable prophet. Who would willingly forgo the delights of feeling morally superior to his enemies? Maybe it is even worth the trouble of being hated so that such a pleasure can be sustained. It is very difficult to make the sacrifices necessary to be a good person, to allow all the deadwood and detritus to burn off, whereas it is very easy to regard others, particularly if foreign, with contempt, an emotion that has as one of its advantages the clear implication that the object of derision and target of disgust is lesser or even subhuman. Is it easier to lower others or to strive genuinely upward? The answer is obvious, at least in the short term. It is genuinely likely that Jonah feels himself to be a traitor, as the people of Nineveh were the true foes of the Israelites, of the worshippers of Jehovah. There is also more than a hint in the text that the man God calls upon to save the lost city is more than a bit of a misanthrope. Adam refuses to walk with God in the garden after the fall because he recognizes that he is naked, because he comes to self-consciously believe that he is defined by insufficiency, weakness, and vulnerability. How can a creature so afflicted retain any respect for himself? He extends his self-contempt as well to Eve, cursing God for having made her. A man who has little use for himself and even less for women is certainly not going to be any friend to mankind as such, and the pride that drove Adam to eat the fruit Eve offered to him is the same tempter that places him in the position of the judge who finds man himself as such wanting. This is the same attitude that drives Cain to call God out for the imperfection of the moral order, the putative cause of his suffering, the same attitude that Job rejects, deciding instead to maintain faith in creation and creator, despite the apparent unjust suffering meted out to him. Jonah does not believe, in keeping with this attitude of contempt for the human, particularly when erring, that the Ninevites are worth saving, and the exceedingly strange and mysterious story appended to the end of his tale makes the fact that this attitude is associated with a counterproductive contempt and faulty moral ordering quite clear. God remonstrates with his prophet. Then saith the Lord, doest thou well to be angry? Jonah 4:4. But the target of the question does not take the hint and drop his resentment and desire for revenge. The Lord himself is pleased that the people of the otherwise doomed city have turned from their evil ways, unlike the stiff-necked and eventually self-destructive inhabitants of Sodom, Gomorrah, and Egypt. God appears to be striving diligently to separate nothing but true chaff from wheat, so that everything of genuine value, however small, can be gathered to him. Jonah, however, less patient and forgiving than the God who has called upon him, leaves the city in a huff and sets himself up in a small shack of interlaced sticks on the outskirts, hoping that some catastrophe might still strike down those he still hated, and waiting to see that glorious day arrive. God prepares a gourd-bearing tree to shade him from the hot sun, an El Keroah, common in the sandy regions of Palestine, and which grows to a considerable height in only a few days. Although it suffices to say that it was lush and leafy enough to provide those taking shelter under its boughs with some respite, Jonah was exceedingly glad of the shade, Jonah 4:6, thus grateful for the fact of the plant and its shelter. But God has another trick up his sleeve, hoping to lead his still wayward and aggrieved follower further toward a generous wisdom. But God prepared a worm when the morning rose the next day, and it smote the gourd that it withered. And it came to pass, when the sun did arise, that God prepared a vehement east wind, and the sun beat upon the head of Jonah, that he fainted and wished in himself to die, and said, "It is better for me to die than to live." And God said to Jonah, "Doest thou well to be angry for the gourd?" And he said, "I do well to be angry, even unto death." Jonah 4:7-9. Jonah is rightfully grateful for the benefits offered to him by the shady tree that grows so suddenly and so fortunately, but he has not yet by any means put his values into the proper order. He is glad of the provision of nature, celebrates nature, even worshiping it for all intents and purposes, as he mourns its destruction with near suicidal intensity. He is glad of the respite offered to him by nature, grateful for that mercy and care. But he remains angry at God above for the much greater respite, mercy, and care offered to the Ninevites. Jonah therefore reveals that he appreciates nature much more than man, and the men he has enmity toward are still men despite their transgressions, and should be valued by a properly oriented moral agent much more than the mere manifestations of the natural world. Jonah thus replaces the true morality that would make him love even his enemies with the false aim and presumption that makes him a self-serving ally to forest and tree. Thus, there is another serious warning embedded in this story of conscience and its call, one against a self-serving veneration of nature, disguising a deep hatred of mankind. This is a reversion to the very idolatry that Elijah warned and warred against. Jonah is very grateful for the tree that grows to provide him with shade and is upset at its demise, regarding that as a moral transgression. God upbraids him, and rightfully so, for so valuing something that he had neither endeavored to produce and had no rights over, and which was, in addition, transient and essentially insignificant. "Then said the Lord, thou hast had pity on the gourd, for the which thou hast not labored, neither madest it grow, which came up in a night and perished in a night." Jonah 4:10. There are no natural resources, no environment, no matter how much vaunted, no intrinsic interest of the planet whose value exceeds the value of mankind, or perhaps of any individual man or woman. Instead, therefore, when nature is elevated above man, the true reason is the pride of the person engaging in that elevation, elevating himself to the position of the eternal judge of mankind and eternally finding it wanting. This is not true celebration of the natural world, but a corrupt and stunningly self-serving denigration of what is purported to be God's highest creation. I abrogate to myself the right to be the judge of all mankind, and along with them, the Spirit who gave them life. The judge, therefore, of God himself, along with that prideful, usurping self-elevation, comes an inevitable and sure-to-be-moralized cruelty and sadism. If nature is more than man, after all, then any aspect of nature can quickly be deemed of more value than any given man. If any man is then no more than a rat or an insect, then anything that might be visited upon a rat or an insect, or even upon a tree, a shrub, or a weed, can, with even more justification, be visited upon man in general, or upon any man in particular. This is an attitude that can only end in disaster, as well as one that is aimed at that very disaster, all protestations to the contrary, from the beginning. To put the natural world above mankind in the hierarchy of ultimate value is to regress to the worship of Baal, to use the archaic conceptualization, and to risk the terrible consequences thereof. To elevate nature in this manner is simultaneously to denigrate both the God who stands outside nature and humanity itself. How could hell not appear and prevail when the cart is thus put before the horse? God therefore rightfully objects. His valuation of the people of Nineveh, despite their sins, is of much greater moral worth than Jonah's self-serving commitment to the gourd tree, to the natural world and its capacity to shelter and provide. And should I not spare Nineveh, that great city, wherein are more than 60,000 persons that cannot discern between their right hand and their left hand, and also much cattle? Jonah 4:7-11. Thus ends the great story of the reluctant and flawed prophet, Jonah, so mysteriously swallowed by the whale. What then are we to conclude in closing from this, the final tale we will consider in our sampling of the ancient stories that serve as the bedrock for our culture, that enable us to see truth itself? That, as in the case of Elijah, God is well characterized as conscience, although not only as conscience. That the individual who refuses to speak when the divine itself comes knocking, whether conceived of in the materialist sense as instinct or in the religious as the direction of heaven itself, dooms himself and his culture to a fate worse than death. That even in the aftermath of such cowardly silence and in the pit of hell, redemption can still be gained and integrity reestablished if the will to do so is there. That there is no difference between the silence of the good and the victory of the authoritarian and evil. That even the city of enemies can be saved by the individual willing to utter the plain truths whose lack engenders the apocalypse itself. That the prophet who redeems can fall prey to his wish for vengeful retribution, even after he has been successful as that redeemer. And that love for man, even in his fallen condition, is a moral virtue higher than worship of the generous, necessary, and bountiful provisions of the natural world. There is, in short, no real difference between the silence of the good and the victory of evil. That is a lot to learn from a single story, a lot packed into a very little space, a lot to digest in a very short time. But all the books we have walked through and considered have that nature, that intense distilling, those continual punches of redeeming wisdom, those profound and vital dramatizations of God, man, and woman. Creation itself, Adam and Eve, Noah and the Tower of Babel, the adventure of Abraham and Moses, the descent and ascent of the reluctant prophet, Jonah. These are the accounts that structure our perception itself, that give the proper weight to our apprehensions, that provide the place to put our experience, that allow us to balance the wisdom of tradition that is the true stake in the ground around which everything rotates with the living experience of the present. The story of man, woman, and God is not one of power or pleasure, but of the sacrificial sequence of transformation that lifts us upward, reconciles now and then and individual with community. The very story that unfolds in its profoundly multifaceted manner as the biblical library proceeds. That is the story we must be told to be sane, that we must now come to understand explicitly to proceed as the pace of the world increases so exponentially, that we are called upon and directed by conscience to embody and incarnate so that we can once again become the inhabitants of the Garden of Eden and play forever in the kingdom of God. Conclusion. The world, as we have seen, is far more than a mere collection of facts. In keeping with that is the observation that there is no simply and directly self-evident pathway from what is to what ought to be, from the fact to the act. Finally, the world is also not a straightforwardly deterministic place either, not a place where atoms, marble-like in their essence, bump up against one another, producing the predictable chain of events that drives or even constitutes our destinies. Instead, at every moment, what we experience, confront, and wrestle with is a domain of vast possibility. We do that in our capacity as veritable images of God, akin to the Logos, the creative spirit whose actions give rise to the cosmos itself with its goodness of order. We do that as we hover with the divine over the primordial waters, speaking reality into being. That spirit of voluntary creative engagement is the first characterization of what is properly put in the highest place in the biblical corpus. This sets the stage for everything that follows, for our understanding of the spirit and story that renders the innumerable facts of reality into something limited and makes them the focus of attention and action in the manner that makes the world habitable, welcoming, stable, opportune, and productive. Our kinship with the Logos comes with a set of responsibilities to properly name and subdue, to act as foil or partner to that process, to steward the walled garden that is the eternal environment of man and woman alike, and to engage in the process of upward striving sacrificial transformation that reconciles the human and the divine. This means as well to hoist the world voluntarily on our shoulders, to attend to the threat of chaos when it emerges, to keep our technological presumption under control, to brave the romantic adventure of our lives, to become the leader of slaves away from the tyrant, and to speak the words that redeem, even to our enemies. We are to do all that in keeping with the intrinsic moral order, the spirit of which is God's, the results of which are written in the great book of the heavenly order, captured in the biblical text, and inscribed on the human soul. Adam and Eve find themselves tempted, however, wishing to become as gods, taking to themselves the right to eat the forbidden fruit, inviting in the influence of the great usurper, the serpent, that is both the snake in the grass and the prideful spirit of Lucifer, the highest angel in God's heavenly kingdom, gone most dreadfully wrong. Eve presumes the right and ability to clasp even what is truly venomous to her breast. This is the pathology of compassion, extended pridefully beyond its purview. The devouring mother, warned of by myth and psychoanalysts alike. The witch in the gingerbread house that is the place of delicious security, too good to be true, and the real home of the enemy of the spirit of the Son of Man. There is no limit to my love. Look at me. Look at me. Adam's companion, tempted by her pathological upward aim, calls upon her partner to incorporate the inedible and welcome the betrayer and usurper, reshaping the cosmic order in the process. Adam, forever willing to strive falsely to impress his mate, agrees, however cravenly, to do so. What are his eternal rationalizations? Of course I can do it. There is no limit to my competence. Anything for you, dear. Nothing is beyond me. It is easier to go along than to oppose or negotiate. I am truly your harmless little friend. Both man and woman fall in consequence of their pride, both in the way that characterizes the temptation specific to each sex, both manifesting the inversion of their own unique and fundamental strength. In the case of woman, this is the capacity to care and nurture, her great calling to people. In the case of man, it is the passion to understand and master the things of the world. Both descend, therefore, into a bitter self-consciousness, nakedness, and estrangement from the God they are now too cowardly to walk with. The world becomes a fallen place, furthermore, after the aim of the archetypal mother and father of mankind goes astray. Condemned to bitter toil, the first couple find themselves outside the heavenly garden, facing the dreadful cherubim who guard the gate, accompanied by the flaming sword that turns every which way and burns. What does this signify? That nothing imperfect can make its way into paradise, and that to sinners, the discriminating process, the logos that bars the road, may well look like hell. This is when profane history begins. Cain and Abel, first two sons of the primordial parents, are also the first two naturally born inhabitants of the world we all now live in. As such, they embody and represent two archetypal and fundamentally opposed modes of being and becoming, which set or constitute the pattern for all human work, which define all the modes of sacrifice of present to future and individual whim to communal harmony and productivity, or the reverse, that define the well-constituted person and state. Abel offers what is of the highest quality, keeping nothing in reserve. He accepts the responsibility that is also adventure and meaning, and it transforms him as he matures and grows. Cain, by contrast, holds back. He offers what is second best, burying his talents and hiding his light under a bushel. He thereby comes under the sway of the spirit of manipulation and deceit. Everyone who takes the easy road ends up lying to themselves about who they are, what they are doing, and why they are doing it, attempting as they do so to distract and mislead God himself. But life is a difficult game. The price of entry is death and the possibility of hell, and any player who does not bring his best to the table will not succeed. The life that could be paradisal is a reward given only to those who willingly, voluntarily, and even gratefully bear the heaviest of all possible burdens, who take even the sins of the world unto themselves. Abel wrestles with the potential that could be Eden if his aim is sufficiently upward, his attention properly directed, and his sacrifices of the utmost quality. In consequence, God has respect unto his offering. Cain, by contrast, chooses the wide and easy road, scheming as he does so for false benefit and escape from the inevitable consequences of his sacramental failures. While walking there, he encounters the same tempter whose blandishments caused the fall of his parents and initiated the dawn of the fallen world. Nothing but misery ensues. Instead of noting his failure, confessing his sins, repenting and atoning, Cain decides to call out God himself for the inequity of the world, resentfully indicating the unbearable success of his brother insinuating and accusing, proclaiming to himself and God that the cosmic order is flawed and the spirit that gave rise to it unjust. The evidence? His own failure. God is having none of this. He informs his wayward grandson in no uncertain terms that he has opened the door to sin in the throes of his self-induced suffering and isolation, and invited the dread spirit who sat at the threshold in to have its way with him. Cain's bitter brooding on his fate is nothing less than the consummated marriage of man and the hateful and envious spirit who rules over hell. Incensed, the brother who refuses to admit to his own error conspires to and then murders Abel, who is also his own ideal, not least despite the God who rejected his second-rate offerings and then dared to upbraid him. This leads to the punishment that is more than Cain can bear, and his sentencing to wander endlessly in the lonely desert of unconsciousness and obscurity. The trouble does not end there. The spirit of Cain reappears in his descendants, doomed not only to become careless worshippers of technology instead of avatars of the ethos that properly orients the world, but increasingly genocidal agents of vengeance whose actions threaten the order that is benevolent itself. Hard on the heels of this degeneration of the generations follow the cataclysm of the flood and the rise of the Tower of Babel. This is the return of the dominion of Leviathan and Behemoth, the emergence first of confusion and chaos, and then of pathological, presumptuous, and misaligned order. Lucifer himself could not have done worse, and that is exactly the point. God makes himself manifest to Noah, the master of the flood, as a character yet fully unrevealed, but at least as the impulse, voice, or spirit that comes to those who have kept their eyes open and prepared themselves properly for the calling. Being a good man, subject, of course, to the limitations of his time and place, Noah can trust himself and God, and therefore has the faith in his intuitions that stems from trustworthy conduct and that guides and motivates forthright action. Sensing that all hell is going to break loose, understanding that God is displeased and cannot be mocked, the prophet and savior builds the ark. This is the vessel that represents the psyche, fortified by integrity, the marriage that is committed, the family that abides together, the community built on an unshakable foundation, and the state that is one under God above. Noah pilots his ship through crisis and catastrophe, shepherding his family, nascent community, and the entire natural order, whose survival does in fact depend on the uprightness and reliability of the human soul. In so doing, he saves and reestablishes the world. The failure of gratitude emerges again soon after, however, in the actions of his son Ham, who laughs when the flaws of his great father are revealed. Ham's descendants are the Canaanites, the eternally resentful failures, sentenced to always be the servants of slaves, doomed to be continually subjugated by and delivered over to the devout followers of the one true God. The presumptuous engineers, who are Cain's grandchildren, then take it upon themselves to build the Tower of Babel, monument to the pride and self-aggrandizement of the tyrant who wishes to take the place of what is transcendentally sovereign. But the inhabitants of the monstrous state soon find themselves unable to communicate with one another. Why? When the proper foundation is carelessly destroyed, when the transcendent spirit of upward striving and truth is forgotten, everyone becomes inarticulate and everything undefined. Everyone scatters, unable to cooperate or compete in peace and harmony, unable to unite in a single direction. Language, the very words of thought and mutual fruitful offering, loses all meaning. Everyone speaks a different tongue. When the central skewer of the world is loosed, attention is fatally divided and fractured, the city disintegrates, and the pre-cosmogonic chaos returns. God reveals yet a different aspect of his character to Abram, later Abraham, the archetypal individual adventurer. Abram is a late starter who decides finally to embark on the journey of his life in consequence of the call to conscience that constitutes the divine voice. He decides, when that voice hearkens, to build his initial altar, to consecrate his life to the upward path, and to sacrifice whatever is necessary in that pursuit. This is what we all still do. Whenever we swear to straighten up, fly right, and set our houses in order, when we determine and decide to improve instead of destroy our lives and the lives of everyone around us, aim up, insofar as up can be conceived. Abandon everything that gets in the way of that to the fires of perdition that constitute the flaming sword. That is the belief in God, to which the discriminating spirit of the divine shows the respect due a proper and acceptable sacrifice. That is the path Abram chooses as he becomes first deceitful scoundrel, then warrior and ally of kings, then sojourner and traveler with the angels of God, or even with God himself. This true follower of the divine calling even shows himself willing, as his character develops, to offer his beloved and long-promised and awaited son to the God to whom he has sworn unshakable fealty. What could such an offering possibly signify? That nothing whatsoever, no matter its value, is to be held in reserve. That everything, particularly that which is most loved, is to be sacrificed to what is yet higher, and, in consequence, and so remarkably, that everything so offered will be retained. Abram changes so completely in the course of his adventure that he earns a new name. The Abraham that he becomes is the very spirit of the good father himself, and, therefore, the spitting image of divine encouragement and chastisement, the very embodiment of calling and conscience. This is the Abrahamic pattern that makes of the art of reproduction not mere sexual congress, but the establishment of the ethos that both spans generations and most truly ensures the survival of the family and the race, that makes the true man the father of nations. And that is not all. Abraham accomplishes all this while acting in the productive, hospitable, generous, and sacrificial manner that makes his mode of conduct in the world a blessing for himself, a means to a stellar reputation, and a benefit to everyone else. He does this as well with the companionship of his wife, Sarai, then Sarah, who simultaneously experiences the revolution of romantic adventure and becomes the true wife and mother of the world. This successful covenant with God, undertaken by man and woman alike, indicates nothing less than the absolute and final alignment of the instinct that invites every child outward into the world with the implicit order of society, nature, and the divine. Why would we expect anything less? Anything other than this fundamental harmony of human soul and desire with the cosmos itself? Are we strangers in a strange land, or the rightful inhabitants of the Edenic garden? Even the most reductive and materialist of atheistic biologists understands that man is by necessity a microcosm, a mirror of the ultimate and absolute. God is yet a different character, again, for Moses and the Israelites. He is the calling upward from the very foundation of the world, the calling that beckons to the worthy to leave the beaten path, pursue their dangerous destiny, and to become like Abraham and Sarah, who they truly are. The God of Exodus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy is the blazing and intensively alive phenomenon whose investigation produces the deepest transformation of character, the divine impulse and voice impelling man to become the leader who eternally invites himself and his people away from the tyrant into the chaotic desert and on to the promised land. That is the archetypal pattern of our striving, of motivation itself, of the story of our life in its unified and mature form. Moses faces his adversary too, just like Adam and Eve, just like Abel. In part, that is the Pharaoh. But it is also, more abstractly and fundamentally, the temptation of power, with the Pharaoh a mere avatar of that alluring spirit. Moses employs force and compulsion when persuasion and invitation would serve. As a result, he finds himself barred by the intractable hand of God from entering the promised land despite his decades of faithful service. This characterization of the divine makes a mockery of any claim that the biblical God is a tyrant. Complex, yes. Multifaceted, yes. Beyond human comprehension in the final analysis, but no friend whatsoever to the tyrant or the would-be slave. Our investigation ended with Jonah, the man who holds his tongue when commanded by God himself to do otherwise. This is a very subtle accounting, and there are few, if any, with more resonance in the modern world. What is the moral of the story of Jonah? That each man is called upon to say his piece, lest the world suffer in the absence of that singular and unique truth. That every man who fails to offer his best and who hides his light and his talent leaves a hole in the world that the offering of his best could have filled, a failure that is on him. That every person bears the responsibility to keep the ship of state afloat, to repent even in the depths of hell, and to journey to the very place where destiny is trying to make itself manifest. We all know, in the aftermath of the horrors of the 20th century, that there is no difference between the lying silence of the cowardly good, but not nearly good enough, and the victory of the forces of the abyss. We all know that there are some sins that corrupt not only the soul, but the world, those very crimes against humanity whose transcendent reality was insisted upon by the judges of Nuremberg in the aftermath of the horrors of the Holocaust. There is simply nothing more real than such evil and the good that eternally opposes it, and therefore nothing more real than the rulers of those respective domains. We know this. We aim our entire literary effort at its representation. We need to know the story. We need to get it straight. We need to live it out. It is no mere matter of mouthing the holy words and making a show of such practice. It is the willingness to bear all in the confident nakedness that is assured by a voluntary covenant with God. That courage to speak is, simultaneously, the willingness to become an avatar of the divine logos, the word that spoke and continues to speak the benevolently ordered cosmos into being, the spirit of the conqueror of chaos and tyrannical state, the voice of wise counsel in times of crisis, the dynamic process that leads the lost across the desert wasteland. This is the reflection of God and the foundation of the rights and responsibility of man and woman, as well as the presence on the receding pinnacle of the entire sequence of challenging peaks and valleys that make up the opportunities and crises, the treasure and the dragons of our venturing forth into the world. All these great, profound, and unalterably memorable stories are characterizations of God and, inevitably, of the men and women who live inevitably in some form of relationship with or to that God. They are, of course, not the only characterizations of the divine that exist. Neither are they the only portrayals or dramatizations of those who abide by its dictates, spirit, or principles, or who fail in that regard. We touched upon some of the alternatives of import, historical and current, in the course of our investigation, discussing the Enuma Elish of the Mesopotamians, which was a precursor to, variant upon, or parallel of the most archaic accounts of God in Genesis and elsewhere, particularly in relationship to his role as victor over the great dragon of chaos. Considering the great story of Osiris, Seth, Isis, and Horus, whose characterizations shaped the Egypt in which the ancient Hebrews sojourned, first as guests, later as slaves, and from which they escaped. And analyzing the sophisticated Taoist conceptions of the moral landscape as the dynamic of yin and yang, feminine and masculine, or, equally profoundly and more generally, chaos and order. This is to say nothing of the many other traditions so well investigated and interpreted by the school of Jung, Neumann, and Eliade, or indeed, presented and examined in and by the many other stories of the Old and New Testament. Another book on the latter, with some additional forays into the former, will follow the present volume. Those gospel accounts and their accompanying texts, of course, continue the characterization of God well begun in the more ancient works, describing his full descent into the suffering world of man, describing the Abraham-like offering of God's Son, who was also himself, to ensure redemption, salvation, and the victory over death and hell, to bring the will of God and the kingdom of heaven to earth. The life and words of Jesus dramatize and describe precisely the pattern of upward striving abandonment of all that is insufficient in the pursuit of the perfect harmony that characterizes the heaven that could be spread upon the earth if only men and women kept their covenant with the divine, realized their true nature, and adopted the responsibility of walking with God. This is the upward striving spirit, exemplified by all the various characters of God, reflecting in the deepest possible manner the ultimate united monotheism, the coming together of everything at the foundation or in the highest place that appears central to the motivation of man, woman, and cosmos alike. In all these stories, all these dramas, all these descriptions of aim, all these characterizations, God is presented as the unity that exists at the foundation or stands at the pinnacle. In the absence of that unity, there is either nothing that brings together and harmonizes, in which case there is a deterioration into anarchy and chaos, or there are the various replacements that immediately swoop in their foul way, to usurp and dominate. The spirit of power that characterizes the Luciferian realm and produces the scarlet beast of the degenerate state. Does that make the divine real? This is a matter of definition in the final analysis, and therefore of faith. It is real insofar as its pursuit makes pain bearable, keeps anxiety at bay, and inspires the hope that springs eternal in the human breast. It is real insofar as it establishes the benevolent and intelligible cosmic order, that infinite place of sinful toil or faithful play. It is as real as the force that opposes pride and calls those who sacrifice improperly to their knees. It is as real as the further reaches of the human imagination, striving fully upward. It is more real than the hell it opposes. It is more real than all that totalitarian certainty and its pathological offer of a life free of burden and duty, and therefore of adventure and meaning. It is more real than power, more real than impulse, desire, wish, or whim. It is as real as the consciousness that contends with the possibilities of life, as real as the burden of decision comprising every glance, utterance, and step forward. It is the offer of redemption and atonement to those who are lost, the foundation of the rights that make free countries both free and desirable, and the spirit of all voluntary and productive relationship with self, with husband or wife, with child, parent, and sibling, with friend and fellow citizen. It is as real as the wrestling with destiny that necessarily characterizes our lives, regardless of how they unfold. There is no perception absent belief, no framing that protects and inspires absent belief, no resilience and moving forward, no unity of psyche or society, no faith, hope, or courage absent belief. We are, therefore, by necessity, those who wrestle with God. If we do that while gazing heavenward, we can align ourselves with the reality that is eternal and walk with that God while we keep and dress the paradisal garden. If we tread the properly sacrificial path, offering upward what is best, keeping to the straight and narrow, maintaining nothing in reserve for ourselves in the narrow sense, if we heed the call of conscience and calling, we can have the redemptive romantic adventure of our life, transforming ourselves as we do so into the giants who once walked the earth, transmuting into the true sons and daughters of God, called upon to do greater things than did the single son who has already and so famously made his appearance and revealed himself. And so, in response to the brilliant Nietzsche, who insisted that man must become he who creates his own values, replicating thereby the call of the serpent in the garden, in response to the nihilists and hedonists who worship the whore of Babylon and thereby risk the elimination of pleasure itself, in response to the reductionistic materialist atheists who deny even the logical conclusion of their own investigations into the guiding role of the deepest of evolved instincts, I say this: it is high time to rescue the highest from its unconscious existence in the lowest, to become fully aware in the face of the magical transformations that now so rapidly face us, and to reestablish our covenant with the God whose magic words structure our consciousness and our societies insofar as they are functional and productive. It is time to take up the wrestling in earnest, to awaken, to return to our origin, and to know the place as conscious adults for the first time. God is dead? No. Deus Renatus Est.
We hope you have enjoyed this Penguin audio production of We Who Wrestle With God, Perceptions of the Divine by Jordan B. Peterson, read by Jordan B. Peterson. For more Penguin audio productions, visit us at penguin.co.uk/audio. Copyright in recording, Penguin Random House, LLC, 2024. Text copyright 2024 by Dr. Jordan B. Peterson. This program was directed by Joseph Ward. Executive producer, Dan Zitt. All rights reserved. The moral rights of the author have been asserted. Thanks for listening.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program.